I would tell any young, thoughtful, friendly, you know, psychologist with some angst and insight into his own soul that what one needs to do is to learn to play the guitar.
All right.
It's Nate Gershfeld here with the Beat Your Jeans podcast, coming to you from Southern California for our final episode of 2020. Man, it's been an interesting year, hasn't it? Yeah, so I thought I'd change things up a bit just for our last show and then share with you just some of my favorite clips over this past year of episodes. There's been a lot going on, a lot to talk about, and so I tried to pick the ones that I found the most interesting. And as we just heard from the intro, that was a rendition of our intro song from episode 200, which technically was in 2019, but I listened to this version so often that it just wouldn't be right not to include it. But it was composed and performed by one of our big fans, Warren Taves, out of Canada, aka Jimmy the Guitar Player. The name of the song is City of Happy Ones, composed by Ferenc Hegedus from the album Beautiful Life. And even though the normal intro is, I think, a little bit more upbeat, I really found myself appreciating Warren's more tempered version. I kind of thought of it like the introvert's version of the song. So thank you, Warren, so much. And as Dr. Hawk would say,
God bless the Jimmy the Guitar Players of the world.
One of our first major announcements in 2020 was to welcome Dr. Jen Hawk to the Beat Your Jeans team. So for almost 180 or so episodes, Dr. Lyle had analyzed and explained questions and concepts, but he and I would often discuss that even though Dr. Lyle would try to be as thorough as possible describing many, many angles to a problem, the sheer fact that we were both male meant that we were lacking a female perspective and the tiny nuances that come from that. And so when Dr. Hawk appeared, it added a new dynamic and a whole different perspective to the show. Yeah, nobody can explain things quite like Dr. Lyle can, but then again, as I've gotten to hear Dr. Hawk's interpretations of things, nobody can explain them like Dr. Hawk either.
Well, we had one announcement. I talked to a ridiculously handsome young man from Australia today. There's like redundancy all over that.
Aren't they all?
They're all... Just, you know, I'm going to make sure I never move down there. Let's put it that way. And he told me, Jen, that he said, you know, I really like your podcast a lot, but it's much better with Dr. Hawk.
Oh,
how about that?
Oh, that's lovely. Oh, and coming from an attractive there Australian at that, it makes it all the better. That's great.
So anyway, the announcement is that Dr. Jen Hawk has graciously accepted that we've invited, Nathan and I have invited her to be a permanent member of our team, of course, a full member of our team. So thank you for joining us, Jen. It's just absolutely grand to have you with us.
It's wonderful. It's really a lot of fun to be here and just to keep you guys in check. So I really enjoy it, and it's been a lot of fun in the small percentage of the 200 episodes that I've been here. But yes, we will have much fun going forward, and I'm really looking forward to it.
And without missing a beat, Dr. Hawk immediately demonstrated her understanding of evolutionary psychology in describing New Year's resolutions. We have health issues now. We are now our first live show of the new year of 2020. Mm. And aside from bad 2020 jokes and hindsight's always 2020, It turns out, I guess now everyone's going to be starting their New Year's resolutions. So our first question is, where do New Year's resolutions come from? Why start something on January 1st or Monday or, you know, whatever it is versus any other random day?
Yeah, I'll jump in here because I've gotten a lot of questions about this recently and talked to a lot of people who are making resolutions and wondering how to best make resolutions. I think the reason that there's a collective move toward this is because it essentially is a little bit anti-ego trapping, in the sense that the expectations are a little bit lowered because everybody's transforming their lives today. Everybody's turning over a new leaf and nobody really expects anyone to make good on it. So that, in addition to the fact that this is just the kind of culturally agreed upon first day of the new year, fresh start, we're finally going to take some action on all of those competitive goals that have been following us around and that we've been acutely aware of for the last 365 days. This is it. This is when we do it. So I mean, there's nothing magical about January 1st. I don't think it has anything to do with the astrology of the Capricorn season or the phase of the moon or anything like that. I think this is just a cultural moment. And it's very much like this is the one time a year where you can go in and announce to the office that you just signed up for a gym membership and you're going to do things differently this year. And people don't hold those expectations against you the way that they're going to the rest of the year, because it's just a New Year's resolution. So you can have a high expectation for yourself, but you kind of have this comfort of knowing that you're in a position where you could outperform people's expectations. And there's not much more motivating than that. That's the opposite of the ego trap, when people are expecting more from you than you think you can deliver. So this at least it starts off with a nice little motivational boost that gets a lot of people going. Of course, it doesn't really last very long for most resolutions, because most people are making resolutions that are objective based, not process based. But that's a whole other question.
Well, maybe we can talk about Fabulous. another show. I want to hear more about that.
Yeah, well, I mean,
let's talk about it. Yeah, let's talk about the process-based goals versus objective-based goals.
Yeah, I mean, that is the heart of any goal setting and any motivational process, but particularly if you're trying to make a successful New Year's goal, is people fall into this trap of linking their objective to all of the external esteem that they think that they're going to harvest when they accomplish that objective. So they're going to lose 100 pounds, and that's going to make them much more attractive as a mate, and it's going to make that, you know, more popular at work or whatever. They're anticipating this big competitive payoff to accomplishing the goal. So they have an objective-based goal, you know, make a bunch of money, or you know, get a promotion, or lose a bunch of weight, or whatever it is. And it's important to have these goals, and it's important to be very specific about them. That's part of the motivational magic, is to have a very specific, competitively relevant goal, because you're not going to feel the motivation to accomplish anything unless it carries some sort of significant payoff with it in terms of what it's going to do for your projected esteem situation in the future. So it's not that having objective-based goals are necessarily bad, but the problem is that most people stop there. So they write their little list and they make their little resolutions. And so we can just do weight loss, for an example, because that's obviously the most common resolution that people have, because it's the most competitively relevant problem for a lot of people, probably most people. So they say, oh, I want to lose 50 pounds this year. And this is great. But then they get into, you know, week two, and they haven't gone to the gym for a couple days in a row, and they've gotten into some indulgent food, and they feel like, well, whatever, I guess I missed the boat this year and I didn't do it, because they didn't set up what the daily fundamentals were going to be on a regular basis to accomplish that goal. And the little fundamentals that are the process are what you really need to be attuning yourself to, because that's going to give you, it actually goes back to that article that we're talking about. That article is saying that the sense of purpose and joy in life is very linked to progress, not achievement per se. It's progress toward achieving something really important. And so that's what we're wanting to orient ourselves to in the process of any kind of New Year's resolution. So instead of you know, asking yourself whether you've accomplished the outcome of a goal. You're looking at whether you did the basics that are eventually inevitably going to get you to where you want to be today. And this initiates the whole self-esteem process, which we've talked about a lot in other episodes. And that really is kind of a whole separate question, but the process of developing pride in your ability to take action towards something that is competitively important for you really is the secret of feeling fulfilled and feeling like you're making meaningful progress toward a goal. So that's essentially what kind of New Year's resolution you want to have and how you should reframe your New Year's resolutions if you want to not hit your first roadblock and turn the table over.
A couple months later, the big news story of all of 2020 that ended up dominating the entire news cycle for the rest of the year. The COVID-19 pandemic began, and this was the first episode where Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle commented on it. But speaking of things going on in the world today, what do you guys think of coronavirus? I'm just going to say it. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well,
just get it
like
out
I think
there.
Of 20, you know, I've been getting, you know, emails, $20 flights to Hawaii or $100 flights to Hawaii.
I got that email too. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. From Alaska. Yeah, so, yep. Very
stock
cheap.
Market's not doing so great, you know.
Sure.
Everybody's in a panic, so to speak.
Yeah, everything's canceled.
Toilet paper is surprisingly gone, which I didn't think coronavirus affects, you know, bathroom habits, but apparently toilet paper is really, you know, in vogue now.
Yeah. Well, you want to take that?
Yeah, there's a few things that I would say. I think the biggest thing that you're seeing is well, there's probably a couple things, but a big thing that you're seeing is just sheer fear of the unknown. So because they call it coronavirus instead of, you know, I don't know, you know,
a bad flu,
white swine flu, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. If it was something that people were used to, then they would feel like they could essentially gauge it. But because it's not as gaugeable because it's a new word and they don't know, you know, what it all means, and it's scary. And so I think you're seeing essentially a species typical reaction that at the first sound of a twig snapping, your immediate reaction is the worst case scenario. And this is a worst case scenario. And it's also, of course, incredible fodder for media. And so, you know, the media is, quote, is doing its job, but in doing its job, we probably never had something with so much publicity, you know,
well,
that, where people can get 24/7. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly the main thing that I was going to say. This is the first post-social media outbreak like this. So it's not just the 24-hour news cycle. It's social media, and now everyone's an expert, right? Everybody who was an expert on the election a month ago is now a coronavirus expert and has to post these manifestos on Facebook about, oh, here's the latest. Here's all the info. Here's what you need to know. Here's what you need to do to protect yourself. So this kind of, you know, no pun intended, but the contagion of social media that gets people really escalated and really scared and really like feeling they need to be the expert. I think that's a big part of the story and why it feels different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been waking up in the morning and, you know, I have a little app blockers to, you know, restrict my usage, but I'll, you know, I've got a few minutes where I can check it. And every time I'm checking the news and I'm thinking, Dr. Lyle, your words are ringing true in my head, which is the media's job is to get the eyeballs on the screen.
Yes.
Yeah. The media's job is get the eyeballs on the screen. I'm just like, wow, my eyeballs are on the screen watching and waiting and just looking at it.
Yes.
My parents were both journalists and, you know, I grew up with the mantra, if it bleeds, it leads. Like they were total scanner listeners and ambulance chasers. And if there was something exciting going on, like we were in the car going after it, because that's exactly what drove the news cycle even back in the dark ages of the 80s. And now it's an even more rapid, ridiculous process. So yes, there's big money on the line to get your eyeballs on those stories. And everybody's their own publisher with social media.
In early June, there was some unrest during the Black Lives Matter protests in various parts of the country. Lots of different perspectives were going on, but our podcast being academic in nature meant that our curious listeners had some very interesting questions about everything going on. And you can listen how Dr. Lyle comments on the current events in a way that only Dr. Lyle can. Dr. Hawk is not with us today. She's taking a little bit of break, But Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. All is well, I suppose. It's all is well in my world, but the world's got its turbulence tonight, but things are looking fine.
Yeah, well, the turbulence, we've had a few listeners send us some very excellent questions. So, Dr. Lyle, would you like to say something about what's going on today and in the world at present moment?
Yes, actually. And folks, Nathan shared some of these questions that I got a look at earlier today. And I have to tell you, I'm delighted with how intelligent and subtle and objective these questions are. These are really, really interesting questions. Very impressive graduate seminar level thinking, which is what I was always hoping that our little podcast might be able to generate one day, and it has. So, however, this is I'd like to be speculating and thinking through these things with folks tonight. However, this is a time for us to be very sensitive about a very, a touchy situation for many people. And so I think the right thing to do is to examine some of the dynamics of the issues that are going on at a later time when emotions aren't necessarily or won't be nearly as high. The follows a general set of life strategies and clinical strategies that I use that many of you have heard before several times, which is, number one, never make a big decision when a small decision will do. We don't want to leap into things and make big decisions, and so I don't want to have my comments look like I'm taking some kind of a position, when in fact what I'm always attempting to do is just to remain as objective as possible and try to learn. I'm in no way a political figure in any vector at all. What I am is I'm just very curious about human nature, and so my sort of academical detachment that might come across might be offensive, and I wouldn't want that to happen. So also, if something is such a great idea to do, something that seems exciting or dangerous, etc., it's always a great idea to wait for a while and do it later. So if it seems like the guy is really hot and really exciting and really cool, and you only just got to know him and you really feels like it'd be a great idea to have sex with him, I'll tell my clients, if it's such a great idea, it'll be a great idea 3 or 4 weeks from now too. That idea won't go away and it won't decay. And the same thing is true about the very complicated dynamics that are going on in our country right now. I'm seeing this now on Tuesday evening, on the 2nd of June, and things are quite a bit different and seem much calmer than they were just 48 hours ago. And I'm very grateful to see that that's happening. The reasons for everything that's going on, I believe, are an interplay of many, many different forces. And those will be worth looking at to try to understand and shed light on from an EP perspective at a later time. It's going to turn out that when two people are in conflict, two or more people are in conflict, or it could be two large groups, if the conflict is very intense, very serious business, then it's going to turn out that the gene survival mechanisms involved are very sensitive about side-taking. So you'll see this in families or in relationships when there's a lot on the line, it gets to be very edgy. And if any individual tries to step in the middle to analyze the process without simply taking one side or another of a conflict, it can go very poorly. So this is something that I want to refrain from doing by not getting in the middle of any analysis here at the moment. This is undoubtedly a derivative of our tribal history. So you're either with us or against us. And under very high emotion, high stakes situations, objectivity is not easy to find. And so as a result, I think that all of us that might be interested in whatever light that our little podcast can shed on anything, I think our ability to contribute anything to this discussion for anybody who's interested in listening, our ability to do that is just as good or better later than it is now.
In episode 225, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk comment on finding your own coalition, specific to your personality, and also to understand what depression actually is and how to get out of it if you start feeling that way. Dear doctors, I'm a 30-year-old junior doctor and longtime fan of the show. I'm highly conscientious, fairly introverted, open, agreeable, and a bit unstable. In my short life, I have been a metalhead drummer, a skateboarder, have studied classical piano and physics, and am now a doctor. I have spent countless hours on each of these pursuits. I have at times been very happy and lucky in love, and at other times miserable and alone. In my early 20s, I suffered a terrible 2-year-long depressive episode that I was only able to escape by completely overhauling my life with a major shift in values and a new single-minded focus on making intelligent decisions and working hard to slowly improve my happiness over many years. I reoriented my life away from exploration, joy, and growth towards basically doing everything I can to make sure I don't get depressed again. I decided to enter medicine in order to have a high-paying, high-status, dependable job, even though it meant 5-6 years of living on a very low income studying something that I actually find quite boring. Unfortunately, I have now been finding it increasingly difficult to relate to the people around me, and I've been floundering in social situations both at work and outside work. I don't have a relaxed, easygoing attitude, and I can't fake it any longer. I also have been single for 2 years and now have few remaining close friends. I think this is partly because I have lived a pretty extreme life and have pushed myself very hard through some tough situations, which makes it hard to relate to others, but also because I'm fairly extreme in openness and conscientiousness department. What advice do you have for improving my social situation? I know Dr. Lyle recommends fishing where the fish are, but I'm struggling to find my fish.
Well, what do you feel like, Jen?
Let's see. So I would say this sounds like a very rarefied personality type. So you've got an extreme mm-hmm. personality type, which is just who you are. So you've had this, you know, crazy history of all of these different experiences, and it has cost you some social connections, and it's made it more difficult to find people to connect with. And that's just what it is. So we can't change who you are. We can't change what drives you and what kind of relationships you're seeking. And so the fish where you fish are metaphor is sort of like, you just have to, I hate to expand upon such a non-vegan metaphor. It's like, yeah. You just have to, it's a numbers game. If you've got a very rare personality, that just means that you have to expose yourself to that many more potential candidates for coalition than somebody with a more average personality or an easier personality to find coalition members. So this is going to apply to people with all kinds of distortion in their big five. Just as the more difficult it is for you to find similarly built humans who are going to enjoy the same kind of things that you are and who are going to see in you a valuable insurance policy that is represented by their friendship, by your friendship with them, which is what friendship really is. If you've got to be providing value to them just like they have to be providing value to you. And, you know, useful to each other when things go poorly in the future, if they do. And so in your case, with the sort of personality type that you have, it's going to be tougher. It's going to be tougher to find those people. They're out there, just like you're out there. But it's a matter of exposing yourself to greater numbers of people who don't qualify for coalition and getting more discerning about, you know, moving quickly on from those people once you rule them out of coalition candidacy and just hoping that hoping that the lords of fate bestow you with people who do qualify for coalition, and then nurturing those connections when and if you do find them. And they're rare. You know, I have an unusual personality. I don't think it's as distorted on the dimensions that you're talking about, but it is distorted on several. And it's been difficult for me to find people who qualify for coalition, but I stumble across them once in a while. But I'm also extroverted enough that I talk to a lot of people and I vet a lot of people for potential friendship and coalition that ultimately don't make the cut. And so you have to just kind of embrace that process and hope that you get lucky would be the way that I would look at that with friendship, with romance, and with anything else.
And then when Jen had good things happen, then she dumps her friends at Beecher Jeans. That's what happens.
Says my number one coalition member.
All right. Now, I want to add a few things. This is just beautiful. All right on. I would say this, that I hear something interesting happening, and that is that the person had a major depressive process, and they're a little intimidated about that because it's a little bit mysterious. And they found that by getting productive and having some kind of moving forward that they got happy again. So let's talk just very briefly so we understand clearly what happiness and depression are. This is sort of a cleaver of a continuum of the qualitative feeling of emotional experience. And of course, those qualitative feelings are actually nothing other than analogs for the underlying probabilities of gene survival that are sitting under those experiences. So obviously an orgasm under the right conditions with the right person should be about as good as it gets for human beings, which we would expect that it would be, because that's how the genes are going to get reproduced. And those would be the genes that you would want to be reproduced. On the other hand, being tortured or some other such thing, when you're about to die, that's about the worst thing. So the feelings are an analog map of gene survival probabilities. And so therefore depression is it may be mysterious to this individual, but it's actually not mysterious at all. If we were to analyze it from this perspective, we would realize that the depression was failure feedback. And so knowing that depression is simply failure feedback and understanding that we don't have to work frenetically to avoid failure feedback, we just have to understand the nature of that feedback and then map our way around that failure, you know, domain more effectively. And so success leaves clues in those arenas. And so we have to just be smart about that. And it sounds to me like this person has not had any serious trouble in many years, and we wouldn't expect them to ever have trouble again. What Jen was talking about was you could think about life as a giant smorgasbord of people. So in that smorgasbord, your happiness is dependent upon, are you going and getting, you know, really good food that you like repeatedly? That's what it's going to be. And so there's going to be a certain amount of novelty that's necessary. You're not going to want to just have brown rice and broccoli every day of your life, even though it might be adequate at some times. So you're going to want to have some novelty, but you're in order to get the novelty and get your coalition to meet a lot of your different potentials for activating your moods of happiness, there's going to be some trial and error and inevitable short-term failure. That's the way it works. We look at this life. This is a young person, but life is really a process of, it's a journey of self-discovery. And that means, that sounds highfalutin, but it's not meant to be. It's essentially you've got a personality or a genetic characteristics that your preferences fundamentally will never change. The job is to figure out, it's basically like a pinball game, that if we know where the points are scored and how to do it, then we can hit those circuits more often and more completely and have greater life satisfaction. It's not fundamentally that hard. Very often when we're unhappy and we're frustrated, the answers are not that far from the surface. They are in relationships that are causing us difficulty. In this case, the person's not very happy about their work. They have done a tremendous job in putting themselves in a position where they can be financially flexible. So go find components within that career that are exciting
Or if they're not, you can always work that career part-time. And if you desperately want to paint and be a Van Gogh, then you can do it because you can work 2 days a week and spend the other 5 days a week as Van Gogh if that's what you want to do. So your nervous system leaves you clues. Just as success always leaves clues anywhere in the marketplace, it also leaves clues inside. You've had experiences of happiness. There's a pattern to those. Find out where to spend your time and energy, where it hits those circuits and scores those points. We shouldn't have to live this life the slightest bit with other than short-term discomfort, given the hand that this person has. There's all kinds of people and all kinds of really interesting and exciting things to do.
A short while later, in honor of an episode on the repeat exposure effect in women, Jimmy the guitar player, also known as Warren Taves, made another song for us. Well, yeah. Speaking of repeat exposure, Jen and I actually months ago,
we're artists.
We had some time, and I think we had some time to spare, and we ended up writing a song to the tune of Michael Jackson's "Beat It,"
uh-huh.
But instead of "Beat It," it's called "Repeat It,"
uh-huh.
And one of our most gifted and talented Jimmy the guitar player listeners named Warren Taves mixed and recorded a guitar version of this song. So
uh-huh.
Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, I've sent you a version. I want you to hit play and so we can get your reaction to it.
Okay. All right. I'm going to listen to it right now.
I will do so.
Okay. I'll,
okay.
All right. All right. Do you have it queued
I'm
up?
Listening.
Okay. So soulful.
Wanna chase Jimmy and do what you can. No time to see a horse, he's not much a man. You want to be seduced by the handsomest man. Those tricky jeans, they just can't see a good man. They need a little time while he extends his hand. You want him to commit, better give him a chance. So be it. If you want the pair bond, repeat it. Repeat it. Go on those 10 dates, repeat it. Show up and look nice, he's in your sight. Give enough time, yeah, for Mr. Right. Repeat it, repeat it. He has to show you that he's really prepared. Those eggs sure don't come cheap, he better truly care. You're watching and waiting to see how he shares. Repeat it till you want him so bad. Repeat it, repeat it. Go on those 10 dates, repeat it. Show up and look nice, he's in your sight. Give enough time, yeah.
Oh, that's very cool.
Warren's a genius. Well, not that it was
Warren
in dispute.
is amazing. Yeah. So for our fans who are curious, if you just heard the audio, just visit the Beat Your Gene or visit my YouTube channel, just Nathan Gershfeld. And we'll put the video up there with the lyrics on there if you want to share it. It's a pretty fun one. So Warren, thank you so much. It's just an incredible video. This guy's just a master guitar player.
Yeah. He's also got, he's got the beard, mustache, looking rugged. He's just he's got it all. He's bringing the whole thing.
A few episodes later, Dr. Lyle answers a question about aliens. I thought it was a very entertaining answer, but also, apparently it caused a bit of a stir since I received quite a few emails about it. Dear doctors, I have a question regarding alien abductions. I once read a book called Communion, which is an alien abductee's accounts of being abducted over several years. In this book, he also detailed other people's experiences. John E. Mack, the former head of psychiatry at Harvard, where Jen went to college, did a decade-long study on 200 alien abductees and did not find any obvious pathologies present across the study subjects. If mental illness is not to account for the feeling of being abducted by aliens, what are the doctor's takes on this strange phenomenon?
How classic. Some guy in a department of psychiatry is going to do some worthless study so he can get on a tabloid front page. He did a decade-long study of 200 people that claim this, like this is something interesting. What a total waste of time. All we're obviously talking about here is some degree of extroversion, obviously high openness, probably not very high conscientiousness, and probably not very smart. So if we took the average IQ of the average abductee, there's a good chance it's below the mean. So because if your stupid friends just might believe you and give you a little status for it. So no, I wouldn't expect any psychopathology out of this. I just expect some rather run-of-the-mill nonsensical humans that believe in all kinds of crazy shit. That's what I think.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's what that is. I mean, what a ridiculous thing for this guy to do. I mean, really? How many people do you need to study before you figure out that these are just a bunch of low-end, not very smart whack jobs, that there's nothing wrong with them? Just do 10. Let's not spend a decade and do 200. What a fool. All right. But really what it was grandstanding, because it was the sexiest thing that this guy could sell at a conference. That's what drove that. Whenever you can't figure out something, why somebody's doing something, look for status. And that's what that research was. All right.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
I take it you don't believe in aliens.
No. Or alien abductions, nor do I believe that people thought that they were abducted.
Right. I mean, that's really Occam's razor answer to this question is that's what they have in common is that they were all actually abducted. Right? Like, let's just consider the obvious hypothesis there. Like, let's just take them at their word.
Yeah,
why
sure.
Wouldn't we?
Right. And despite, the amazing thing is about that is that, like, all of the radar work that we do and the motivation for the aliens, obviously what the aliens wanted to do was they wanted to come and not talk to any of our heads of government, heads of military, heads of science or anything else. No, they wanted to talk to 200 morons. That's who they wanted to talk to. And otherwise leave no sign. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anybody that it would say it is an idiot, and anybody that believes it is an idiot, and anybody that studies it is an idiot. The whole thing is total fiasco.
But Dr. Lyle, what do you think about the movie Independence Day? That one was pretty
good. That's a good movie. A good
it
movie.
It's totally basically a documentary.
All right.
Oh, man.
All good.
Well, I know better than to try to weigh in on that question when Doug's in that much of a rant about something feeling that disagreeable.
Oh, so your mystic chip is,
Well, yeah, I think it's coming down to openness. It's going to openness and status opportunity. Not only, the author of the study and the paper and his own status mongering, but also, Doug's touching on it, the sort of low hanging fruit of social status available to the local yokel who gets to go to the bar and tell a story about being abducted. So,
I would do it myself.
Yeah. It's just tall tales, like control for people, like who's most likely to tell a tall tale in general. Yeah. It's going to be all of those characteristics that you're talking about with a dose of, again, the sort of the extroversion to go weave a tale in a social setting about it to gain a bunch of status. So, but he's the head of psychiatry, so he's not thinking about the world this way. I also just, since I've been tarnished by my association.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Want to state for the record that I don't, was not part of that department and don't know the guy and don't completely have no knowledge of any research or any work that he's done and have nothing to do with my Harvard experience. So
there you go. There you go. You're clean.
And in what felt like a social media and news grand finale for 2020, the U.S. presidential election between President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden happened, and we got some commentary from Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle. And we are anxiously awaiting the certified results. So, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, take it away. What say you about this this interesting?
Well, event? This is why you have a PhD in political science from Harvard, for just times just like this. So let's hear what Jen has to say as you look at this whole thing. Jen, just give us a little feel of your survey of it.
Yeah, well, yeah, Doug and I had a good conversation with this morning for people who are on our membership site on the Living Wisdom Library. We actually talked about this on our membership, our weekly membership chat. And so people may have already kind of heard the points that we'll go over today. But I think the main thing that comes out of this whole experience, and anyone who's been listening to the podcast for any amount of time knows that they can come to the conclusion on their own that it's very likely that Doug and I voted for different candidates, even though we share a lot of politics in common, because evolutionary psychology kind of it really drags you into a more libertarian position, because it really communicates very effectively through behavioral genetics and just through individual difference. The fact that humans are individuals. Humans have individual preferences. They are wired up in very individual ways. We obviously have many, many things in common, but the pursuit of happiness that is so central to our entire premise of democracy is actually a very individual process. So as you come to terms with that through EP, I think it's really inevitable that it starts to seep into your politics as well, because you reach this point where you realize it's actually very tyrannical to impose your idea of the pursuit of your happiness on anyone else in the population at all, let alone the other half of the population that doesn't agree with you. So I think we have that kind of premise in common, even though we sort of drift over to the other sides of the bell curve in terms of our share not share dimensions and the other things that would sort of determine what party we're most affiliated with. And you know, I think the main thing we're obviously nothing is completely official yet, although it's looking pretty official. I don't know how much of a chance that, you know, Vegas doesn't think there's much of a chance of this turning around. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I start to think that, okay, this is really happening. But what we were talking about this morning on the Q&A is that this is really amazing confirmation of how robust American democratic institutions really are. And when I say democratic, I say that with a small d, you know, small d democratic, small l liberal. Like this is the machine that the founders designed to be incredibly resilient to even really ridiculous unforeseen challenges, and really toxic personalities in our leaders. So say what you will about Trump, but the guy is not the most presidential of characters to occupy that position. And we like to think that position is reserved for somebody who is much more presidential in character, even though that would be a little bit of a historical mistake to assume that everybody who's been in the White House has had that kind of gravitas. They have not. But no one has been under as much surveillance and scrutiny with that sort of bombastic, buffoonish sort of personality as Trump. So for us to get through that with the pressure of all of the media attention, all of the social media around it, and now to be in the midst of this very messy, contested situation with, you know, a sitting president crying foul, like these are challenges that lesser democracies would not be able to weather. And we're doing really just fine. The process is working just as it should. You know, people on all sides of this and on both sides of the aisle, including Doug and I, both have faith in the courts to do what the courts need to do to the extent that they are summoned to resolve this. And I'm not particularly worried about the outcome either way. I am an institutionalist first and foremost. So while I have specific personal political preferences that I would like to see echoed in my president, who is in that position is much less important than the upholding and survival of the institutions that preserve the process. And that seems to be very healthy, and healthier than I would have thought. So that's all good news from where I sit with my political scientist hat on.
Totally. I couldn't agree more. This is, I said earlier that I liken this to a, like if you heard that there was a new Steven Spielberg movie out and everybody told you it was a great one, you would be riveted because you know the quality of Spielberg and you know that if this is a great Spielberg movie, this is going to be phenomenal. And this is that equivalent. In other words, the Spielberg is the founding fathers. And that is the collective human genius that gave birth to a phenomenal country. What makes the country phenomenal isn't, you know, the Rocky Mountains and the beaches of Florida. It's the legal system is what makes it great. And at the heart of that legal system, it is how do you defend the transmission, you know, and the selection of power, and how do you limit it? And so that took just almost unbelievable ingenuity, as far as I'm concerned, and negotiation to come up with the design that we have. And so this is now a moment, a Spielberg-like moment, where it's going to get challenged hard. Trump is not somebody that backs off from anything. So he is utterly shameless. You cannot cow him by embarrassment into anything. So if he thinks he's been cheated, or if he thinks that there's a way to use any system into his advantage, he will. I don't believe he'll do anything to cross the line. I don't think that that's in his DNA. I think what's in his DNA is to use every possible advantage that he can. And so now we, as Jen would say, you're not going to get challenges like this very often, but the whole point of the system is to be able to withstand whatever it is that can be thrown at it. And now we're going to get the kitchen sink. And so to me, it's a Spielberg movie. We get to sit back and watch the next 2 months, watch this unfold. And I have no idea, you know, I can guess what I think is going to happen, but that's meaningless. In other words, what I get to do is sit back and watch the American system work under pressure. And that's a spectacular thing to observe. And I'm looking forward to it. As Jen says, no matter what happens, I'm looking forward to watching the process work. We're getting to see a historical moment. You know, it's kind of like watching the last 4 minutes of a great Super Bowl. It's like, okay, now we're going to get to find out what happens. And let's, you know, the referees are the best we've got in the league. We've got instant replay. We're going to do everything we can, and we're going to find out what happens. And somebody wins and somebody loses. And then I think everybody lives with it. You know, maybe not happily, but they do. I think then that's how I think this goes down.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, how many people, I think a big piece of the current debate, at least, you know, the internet debate, is you've got a lot of people who were not old enough to remember the 2000 election.
That's amazing.
Live through it, weren't glued to their TV. Isn't that amazing?
I know.
I used to, my opening question when I used to teach poli-sci, just to kind of get a sense of the room as an icebreaker, was what's your first political memory? And in the time that I was teaching, I sort of watched it go from, you know, fall of the Berlin Wall up to, you know, it started to creep north until people started to remember, like, you know, Clinton's election, and then pretty soon it was 9/11. You know, they're just getting younger and younger all the time.
I guess the Chicago, you know, the 1968 Democratic Convention is not out there anymore.
Oh, that's funny. So you and I were similar ages when we had our first. For me, it was the Berlin Wall. So that was like the moment, or maybe the Iran-Contra hearings on TV. That was a big deal too. You know, sort of sitting and watching the Ollie North sit there and answer questions. So those were my formative moments. But yeah, I mean, I think you're most of these whatever we're into now, Generation Z or whatever it is. They didn't have that experience, and I don't think there are a lot of people, even Democrats, who are sitting around gnashing their teeth, thinking that Gore should have been president and that this was all illegitimate. And, you know, both terms of W's presidency were a sham and never should have happened. And it was all, he was just installed by the court. That lasted for a couple of years. There were definitely people on the left who did feel that way and probably would still, if you press them, they would, that's the narrative that they would come up with, certainly W's first term. But I don't think anybody really thinks of him as an illegitimate president. And you know, they might not like him and they might not agree with things, but that was, I mean, talk about a hotly contested, crazy, you know, down to the wire Supreme Court decision. I mean, that those were crazy times. That this seems much more civil and measured compared to that. So for people who just don't have that perspective, it's like, yeah, we've actually been here before fairly recently. And we got through it just fine. And it was the look like things were going to go to the other guy that time. And this is how it works. It just pivots back and forth. I mean, we were talking in the Q&A today, how a lot of Republicans are upset that some of their nominees on the court are not playing out like they were supposed to. You know, these guys are supposed to be very much in the party's pocket, according to the perceptions of a lot of people who vote for their president based on that idea. And really, judicial independence is a thing, and we want it to be a thing. We want those justices to get in that position and you know, follow precedent, follow their conscience, follow something that is outside of party affiliation. That's why they're there. That's why these are lifetime appointments. So we have these just beautiful, I mean, this is what checks and balances are all about. And nobody has been able to copy us as well as we came up with it. This is just an incredible system.
Yeah. All cool. All grand. We sit back and watch the movie. Popcorn. Yeah, and also, I also spoke about this morning, I talked about how the feelings that people have. And so the feelings that people have are vastly more intense than is warranted by the actual outcomes. That isn't, unless you were, oh, I don't know, maybe you were some executive in an industry that was looked like it was going to grow large under Trump, and now it's going to have its wings clipped. Or if you're an industry that was hoping like crazy that Biden would win, because you know that industry, that you're poised to make a lot of money. Very few of us have a significant direct relationship or correlation with our outcomes and any political process. The beauty of it is that at this point, the United States government, the United States, certainly federal government, actually any level of government, has surprisingly, the variances in how the government can work are almost irrelevant to the individual citizen. It isn't entirely true. If you're a developer wanting to build on the coast of Oregon and you built, you know, had 1,000 acres up there and you wanted to put a golf course in, and now the Coastal Commission, you know, is saying, no, you can't do it, even though we told you 10 years ago you could do it. You know, you've got a political mess on your hands, and your life, you know, may be very significantly influenced by that. But the vast majority of people do not have their lives actually influenced by politics. And that's because the decision-making powers of the government and the variances and outcomes of how the government makes decisions are in relatively narrow ranges, largely as a result of a very complex set of checks and balances that keeps the decision-making, as Jen likes to call it, little c conservative. In other words, not conservative politically, but conservative in the fact that it doesn't change quickly. However, your feelings don't follow that. And so it can be a little bit confusing I don't know why I have this scene seared in my memory, but some college football team lost a big game, like a national game, and they cut to the cheerleaders and they were crying. and I remember it was very like, you could tell it was a big thing. And of course, it does feel like a big thing. But the reason why it feels like such a big thing is because you feel like you're a member of a village that just went to tribal war. You know, if you're one of those cheerleaders, you're about to be one of the spoils of war.
When the truth is, of course, God. I mean, that is exactly what's going on. So the, in the same way that if you're the member of the losing posse or winning posse in a national election, you are, it's hearkening back to Stone Age processes where this was a huge issue in your life of leadership shift in a village of 40 or 50 adults.
Yeah,
and your little coalition, if things go badly between your big guy and the other challenging big guy, then that's not so good for you. And that will have actually a potential significant change in your outcomes on some issues that are very important to you. Whereas, and you also feel very hyped up and agitated to try to convince everybody that your position is right and the other position is wrong. And the reason why you are energized there is because you believe that what it is that they think has significant meaning for outcomes for you that are important. Now, hopefully everybody can run the math. There's 150 million voters. Whether you convince seven people, you go out there and yell and scream and go 7 for 7 and flip 7 votes, it's not going to have any impact at all. But in the Stone Age Village, if you flip 7 votes, it would have enormous impact. And so as a result, you have within you a feeling of imperative and angst about whether or not you can convince your friends and relatives and you know your stray Uncle Louie out there who is thinking wrongly and needs to vote for X instead of Y. That feels important to you, and you can feel incensed and frustrated and angry and everything else under the sun and desperate. In other words, you can have a lot of very intense feelings only because these intense feelings are echoing to Stone Age processes that were very important, as opposed to the current situation where the outcomes are, for all intents and purposes, irrelevant. I cannot honestly tell you, having lived through however many presidents I've lived through as a conscious human, my first consciousness about the presidency would have been with Jimmy Carter. So I would have been about 16 at that time. At that point, you're old enough to chew gum and walk and be drafted and all kinds of stuff. So I can, but when I think about my life experience and what was happening on any kind of day-to-day or month-to-month or year-to-year basis, I cannot honestly tell you that my life has been in any way measurably influenced by any of the half a dozen presidents that have come since Jimmy Carter, since I was awake. And I think honestly, as I think you used a word, Jen, monitored. If you were to monitor your own internal experience and get a graph on it of the last 30 years of your life and try to chart whether or not when President X was in charge, you were 5% happier than when President Y was in charge, I think it would be absurd. There's no way that's true. Your future in your life is overwhelmingly dependent upon the esteem dynamics of your existing situation, not Washington politics.
Yeah, this discussion really hit it home for me and reminded me why I enjoy hearing Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk's analysis as they back up the camera and take a good look at what's really happening. All right, guys, it's been an interesting year with some ups and some downs, but I'm really looking forward to a new year, and I hope all of you listening have a relaxing and fun new year as well. I really do appreciate all of you listening and supporting the podcast with your insightful, thoughtful questions and comments. It really wouldn't be the show that it is without you guys, so thank you. If you'd like to learn more from Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, you can visit www.esteemdynamics.com. and join their Living Wisdom Library. If you're seeking to escape the pleasure trap and make some healthier changes, you can visit www.fastingescape.com and schedule a phone consult with me. Happy New Year, everybody. Have a wonderful night.